for a couple summers, we were going around playing like little clubs and bars, or even like in the spring flings at universities. We were college bands, and us, Fish, Widespread Panic, all, sometimes we do co-bills, and we went Lollapalooza one year, which we went to, me and John and the band and some other friends, and we were like, we should just do a Lollapalooza, but with our bands, so we can play outdoors at like real venues in the summer instead of being stuck in little clubs when it's nice out. So I'd like to say it had broader thought process than that. We went to Lollapalooza and we're like, we gotta figure out a way to do this. Now, happens to a lot of great bands. That was a great vehicle for that, and it kind of became a part of the times, that big, really diverse kind of musical dupe that was the 90s. So it did occupy a great place, and I think that's partly why it took off. But really, it was just Blues Traveler's way to play a bunch of big shows with our friends in the summer.
Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Chandler Kinchla, the guitar player for Blues Traveler and his new band, Warhorse. Born in Ontario, Canada, Chan moved to Princeton, New Jersey, where he met his Blues Traveler bandmates. After graduating high school, the band moved to New York City, where they gigged around town until they secured a record deal. After they were signed, a bartender at one of the clubs they played at introduced the band to David Letterman. The band played his late-night show many times over the years, which helped put them over the top. Blues Traveler has gone on to record 15 studio albums that have sold more than 10 million units and played over 2,000 shows in front of more than 30 million people. During the interview, we talked about the majesty of New Jersey, playing 300 dates a year in New York City clubs, the reasons for creating the Horde Tour, playing dates with Warhorse, and much more. I spoke with Chan from his home in Los Angeles. Which means it doesn't matter what our connection is like. Yeah, all right. Yeah.
It'll have a nice, clean, I get it.
All right, let's start here. I read that you're from Canada, and I'm just curious how you made it to New Jersey, and that was the beginning of the music business for you, really, but tell me.
My Canadian story is not all that interesting, or maybe it is. My father, who's from Boston, was up in teaching. He's a professor, or was, dearly departed dad. He was teaching at McMaster University, which is right outside of Toronto. And he was up there for about 3 years, 3 or 4 years with my mom. And they had me up there. 11 months later, after my birth, my father, and I am, or was, I haven't checked lately, but up until recently, I was the heaviest baby at the Hamilton, Ontario hospital, 11.1 pounds. So I left my mark on Canada. But I moved down here at 11 months old, and my dad got a gig, professor at Princeton University, and that's where I grew up, Princeton, and that's where the band, my band Blues Traveler, is from as well.
So let's go to Blues Traveler for a bit, because of all places in New Jersey, you would not expect Princeton to birth the band.
There's a pretty interesting thing. It actually is a hotbed. There's a well-known band, the Spin Doctors, lead singers from Princeton. And as a matter of fact, he moved up to New York with us, or when we moved up to New York City. And also Trey Anastasio from Fish grew up in the Princeton area. And the band Ween is from that general area. I will say Princeton, and it was my experience, and it kind of part of where I met some of the other guys, Princeton being a fairly affluent, very diverse kind of betwixt Philly and New York City. A lot of the university professor people, pretty well educated. So the arts were always, we always grew up going to plays and concerts and having stuff come to Princeton. That stuff was really appreciated. And in the school systems, they really leaned on that. And there was plenty of resources for that. And I ended up actually meeting Brendan and John from Blues Traveler in the rehearsal rooms from we had a big jazz big band in high school that was kind of award-winning from around the country. I was more of a self-taught rock guy, but they let me use the amps and the little studios. I'd just skip class and go in there. Eventually, Brendan and John saw me in there all the time and figured they should say hi. So, strangely, Princeton actually had a pretty nice atmosphere for, you know, any kind of artistic leaning type. And I think it was pretty respected. So, you know, we weren't coming up from the mean streets. That happened a little later.
You know, I always loved Princeton and that general area. I lived in Jersey for a while myself, mostly at the Jersey Shore. But I played a lot up and down, you know, in New Jersey in the concrete jungle. When people think of New Jersey, they think of Newark. They think of Bayonne, you know, and it's so far away, you know, Princeton, that whole idea of what it's like. It's beautiful out there.
No, Princeton's gorgeous and the shore is gorgeous. I mean, you know, the part up around New York City is definitely more urban. But the vast majority of the states, the Appalachian Mountains, the Delaware Water Gap, the Jersey Shore, the Pine Barrens. I mean, it is called the Garden State for a reason. All that volcanic soil washing down those old mountain ranges, the Appalachians, makes really good tomatoes and silver corn. So a lot of people, I guess, don't really appreciate the majesty that is New Jersey. But those of us who know.
Yeah.
I heart New Jersey.
Got it.
New Jersey okay. For lovers.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So I'm curious how the band actually kind of broke through, since you're from Princeton and that's disconnected from New York, really. How did you break through?
That's for sure. But there's a train that takes us right into New York, you know, in about 50 minutes from the middle of Princeton, because, you know, Princeton being a very historical place, that was where a lot of wealthy Ivy League kids went. And so they set it up so the kids could go back home to their, you know, turn of the century, you know, 18th, 19th century wealthy parents back up in the New York area. And we really did grow up going to see plays and music and all kinds of things in New York, Yankees games. So going to New York was something we were all quite comfortable with. And even, you know, in our teens, we would just go up there for fun or tons of school field trips. So New York was definitely kind of always there growing up. But, you know, we, being a high school band, we were pretty certain we were going to make it big, but we figured we needed to move to New York to do that. So in 1987, when we graduated, John, our lead singer and harmonica player, graduated a year previous. So we had been going up my senior year and playing like talent, you know, open mic nights, I should say, and any little stage we could bum rush. And so we moved up there in 87 as a full band and lived in a hellhole in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. And, you know, the first year was not very glamorous. Let's put it that way.
But again, that's the way it's supposed to happen, really. That's how you get your chops together, playing a lot and just being together.
And a great thing that happened is right when we moved in the city, they had revoked what was called the cabaret law, which meant you needed a special license, which there were only a certain amount, and it was a very sketchy kind of, you know, New York corruption thing to get one of these. Well, anyway, they finally revoked it in 86, 87. And up until that point, you needed this to have more than three people on stage.
Yes, so right. I remember it. Yeah.
Right when we moved in, every little dive on the Lower East Side was having, you know, bands. And I mean, we're talking dives. At that point, you know, late 80s, Lower East Side really was kind of a no-go land past Second Avenue. And especially like Alphabet City, that whole area, there's all the squatters. It was quite exciting for a bunch of lads fresh from the cloistered confines of Brigadoon in central Jersey. So we, at a certain point, we had a stage to play 6-7 nights a week till 4 a.m. Some little bar somewhere would have us, and generally not for money, but we had a place to play. So that is those first year or two. That's really where we didn't really rehearse. We just kind of throw songs together and play them over and over again on stage. And slowly but surely, people started showing up. Who knew?
All right. So it's one thing to play in a lot of bars and just places like that. It's another thing to actually kind of break through in the big stage. So what happened?
Well, we, at a certain point, our first year was not pretty, but the second year in New York, and we're playing, honestly, seriously, 300 dates a year at this point, all around New York. And then some of our friends' colleges right outside of New York, because a lot of our friends had gone to college. And a couple of the guys in the band were going to the new school, so we had some studio space to use. But we slowly became kind of the biggest little thing in New York. I mean, we packed everywhere we played. Well, once there's, you know, once there's the smell of there might be money to made, then record companies come around, you know. But at the time, it was kind of hair metal, you know, that hair metal 80s dreck, and, you know, power ballads and all that, like, over-the-top glam stuff. Everyone wishing they were Van Halen, but there can only be one Van Halen. And that was what was big, or, you know, Michael Jackson, Prince, that kind of stuff. We didn't fit into anything like that. There was none of, this is pre-grunge, pre-Americana, pre-singer-songwriter. So we definitely were kind of in a weird glob of groups, but we were packing it in enough that, and we were in New York, so the record guys were there. The guys that could actually sign us were there. They just had to go down to the bar. They didn't have to make a big trip out of it. So eventually, between that, also fortuitously, Bill Graham's son was going to Columbia at the time, and he was looking for a band to manage. Bill Graham, the famous empresario. So right at the time we were talking to record companies, Bill Graham came on board to manage us. And between his juice and what we had got going in the city, we managed to get signed. Now, that seems like every band's dream, to get signed. But getting signed is just the beginning of the work. Because, I mean, getting signed is almost nothing. Getting signed means now you're in the big pond and you can get lost in the big, you know, we had a little control over New York. We could just play in these little bars and pack it in with our friends, you know. But, you know, being in New York and being kind of the thing, the it thing in New York, and meeting a bunch of the people that can make things happen was got us to that next level. Then we had to do it all over again in the back of vans all over the country. But that's, you know, that was the next phase.
And it took a while until you actually had a hit then, right? You were, what, three or four records in?
Yeah, well, so we signed with A&M Records. And this podcast seems to be leaning a little more the inside of the industry is what I'm gathering. So Patrick Clifford signs us. Right at that point, A&M was bought by PolyGram Records, or what they called PolyGlom. So we didn't know it at the time, but we had just got signed, but then PolyGram bought them, and they were going through all the acts they had and getting rid of them or keeping them. And they had a big meeting, and they were basically smashed and trashing. And we had just gotten signed. Because our deal was so small, because we got a very small deal to make the record. I mean, we didn't keep any of the money. But our deal was so small. Patrick Clifford, our guy, was so pumped about it. And we, you know, we had a live crowd. They didn't have to give us tour support and all that stuff. We were kind of self-sustaining. So we weren't much of a risk. So we passed through the eye of the needle there. But, I mean, I learned about it later. All kinds of great bands were getting dropped from A&M. So our little journey with A&M almost stopped before it began. But at the time, A&M Records and record companies was, you know, the record companies were kind of a smaller family. It was just, PolyGram owned a bunch of record companies, but A&M was pretty much its own thing. It had its studios over in Charlie Chaplin's old studios, its headquarters in Los Angeles. And they, you know, record companies in general then really developed their acts, you know. So that first record was fairly inexpensive. We kind of got some good play at college radio. But, I mean, I'm sure it didn't make anyone much money. But, it, you know, it wasn't a financial drain. So that kind of continued. I mean, we were trying to make every record accessible and get some songs on the radio, but by the time we got to Four, our big record in mid-90s, that was our fourth record, A&M was really firing on all cylinders. We had great relationships with everyone there from all the time and work we'd done kind of promoting the last records. I think the market had kind of changed. It was really that era, because MTV was so diverse, I think people were looking for a lot of different things. And we had, up until that point, really developed our own, us and bands like Phish and Widespread Panic, had really developed our own kind of fan base. So we, I think we were pretty comfortable just going that route, just being this kind of underground live entity, kind of like the Grateful Dead or something. That was kind of one of our blueprints for a lot of these bands coming up. Because radio didn't sound like us, and doing pop hits and all that just didn't make any sense. But Four came around, we made a pretty focused record, and lo and behold, as we were surprised as anyone, we got some hits on the radio. But I think it's just a lot of putting the right product together, getting lucky, having the right people. You know, a lot of things have to come together for that to come off. And we were as surprised as anyone, so that was a fun year or two.
Did you work with Mike Gormley at all?
I don't recognize him, Mike Gormley, no.
Okay, he might have been before your time
David
there.
David Easterly was one of our kind of guys that looked out for us, and Al Cafaro, and Al Marks. I mean, there's a whole litany of great
yeah,
people.
Yeah. There are 15 simple mix fixes that can instantly take your mixes from amateur to pro level. These are the secrets that the top engineers know that most musicians don't. That's what you'll find in my Mix Fix playbook. Head to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now. Yeah. Okay. Tell me about David Letterman, because I read somewhere where you felt kind of beholden to David in a way.
Well, David, we played this little bar called Mondo Cane. It's like 150 people down in Greenwich Village, and we used to just play, we'd play there weekly, like every Tuesday, and we used to just pack it in. Eventually we started that, once again, we had a club owner who took a chance on us, and the first 3 to 6 months weren't great, but at a certain point we just started packing it in, and we would break all their bar records. Well, one of the bartenders who was moonlighting as a bartender, he was trying to get into production and be a producer with television. He, right around the time we got our record out, got a gig talent buyer for David Letterman. Now, we all grew up, especially John and I, just in awe of David Letterman. That was kind of a counterculture dude. And I would just sit there. I would never miss it. And Paul Schaefer in that band. And, I grew up sitting around all night running my scales, watching David Letterman in the wee hours of the morning. So we're huge fans, and then he was the first guy, and then he loved us and he had us back over and over again. And I think early on, that was our first national exposure. So we do owe a lot to Dave and the whole team that kept us, and we were kind of a local New York thing, so it kind of worked too.
Very cool. All right. Talking with our mutual friend, Paul Ill, he mentioned something to me that I was unaware of, and I didn't see anything. I, did a lot of research on you, and I didn't see anything like this about the Horde tour.
Yeah.
So that was a reaction, right?
Well, I'm not so sure it was a reaction. It was, we, for a couple summers, we were going around playing like little clubs and bars or even like in the spring flings at universities. We were college bands, and us, Phish, Widespread Panic, all would, like, sometimes we do co-bills, and we went, Lollapalooza one year came, the first year of Lollapalooza, which we went to, me and John and the band and some other friends, and we were like, we should just do a Lollapalooza, but with our bands, so we can play outdoors at like real venues in the summer instead of being stuck in little clubs when it's nice out. So I'd like to say it had broader thought process than that. But it was really, we went to Lollapalooza and we're like, we got to figure out a way to do this. Now, happens that a lot of great bands were kind of, that was a great vehicle for that. And it was kind of, became kind of a part of the times, that big, really diverse kind of musical soup that was the 90s. But so it did occupy a great place. And I think that's partly why it took off. But really, it was just Blues Traveler's way to play a bunch of big shows with our friends in the summer.
So it was your idea, right?
Yeah, Blues Traveler's, saw Blues Traveler's baby. We talked everyone into it, for better or for worse.
Yeah, but that's a big part of it. People have to trust you to do something like that, and they obviously did.
That was very cool. It was like a musical, advanced musical summer camp. I mean, everyone got to see so many amazing bands play and got to know so many of those musicians. So it was a fantastic time.
Okay, let's jump up to now. I know that you're playing a lot of gigs, kind of as a solo artist, and then also Warhorse. So how did all that come about?
Well, Blues Traveler is my day job, which I love dearly. I just got off 4 months of tour with Blues Traveler, but you know, Blues Traveler doesn't work that hard. Only 4 or 5 months a year. And when my kids were young, now, John's such an amazing singer with the band, I always just let him do the singing for obvious reasons. If you got a singer like that, you let him go. But it's also always something I was kind of interested in. But when I had young children, I kind of leaned on Mr. Mom. You got to make some choices, especially when you're gone, you know, touring a lot. When I came home, I just dedicated myself to my kids, and it was great. Well worth it. But my kids grew up, I kind of stopped partying, and I realized that I needed a hobby. So I thought to myself, I like playing guitar. Maybe I should do that. At first I started a band with Paul and some other great local musicians here in Los Angeles. And the idea is that there's so many great musicians and we're off the road often, but at different times. So it's kind of a loose confederation of local guys. Though there is a four people that are the main focus at this point. And we just finished an album. As a matter of fact, Warhorse and the horse that we've been on is streaming everywhere and available on Experience Vinyl. It's fun starting your own project from the ground up. It's like I'm hawking like I did back in the day on the street corners of New York. Got handing out flyers to get people to come to our shows. Well, I was doing so much songwriting and working on my singing with my acoustic guitar. I enjoyed that so thoroughly that I started doing kind of pretending to be a singer-songwriter, which is really fun too. And probably the best way to improve your singing is to sing alone in a mic with a guitar in front of people. It's sink or swim there, baby. Now, I really enjoy it. Do other people? It's not for me to say. But I'm having a blast. And that vehicle is called Chan Gang.
Very cool. That's a great name. Love it. All right. I'm always curious about the evolution of gear for a player. Because we're all looking for the perfect wave. And rarely do you find it, or you find it for a little bit, and then you're off to a new one, to find a new one. So tell me,
you got to move to a new, I mean, surfers keep moving all around the world, right?
Yeah, right. So what was the rig that you started with, and where are you at now?
Well, what I started was when I was 11 on my friend's Sears Fender Lorry. Which I stole, or Sears Lorry was the name of the guitar, which I stole, which he nicely gave to me after I wouldn't put it down when I went to his house. Then I think I switched over to a Peavey, and I got a Gibson SG, which I have down the hall in my closet as we speak. That was my first real guitar and real amp. And back in the mid 80s, early 80s, Peavey was kind of a big deal, and it just looked cool. But Peavey was a well known amp. Solid state. Yeah, baby. And then Oh, we toured. So Bill Graham got us on tour with the Allman Brothers in the early in the 90, 91. So we'd spend summers touring with the Allman Brothers. And I saw Warren Haynes had Soldano amps. And Warren's then and now is an amazing guitar player. I'm like, I'm just going to get Warren's rig. Because that's, you know, because we were, I was coming up. I had a little money. I was coming up out of little clubs. So I was just looking for what these, you know, these guys playing on big stages were. So then I was Soldano all through the 90s. Guitars, I was kind of all, it's like I was doing ESP, kind of Stratocasters, custom ESP. And then I got in these Modulus graphite guitars, which is probably a wrong road to go down, but they gave them to me free and they looked cool. But it was such a hectic, you know, that era in the 90s, I was literally on tour the whole time. And so I just kind of grabbed together whatever I saw, whatever seemed handy, whatever was given to me, and started using it. I've gotten a lot more particular about what I like. And now I play with Bogner amps, and I've been doing that since around 2000. A great kind of boutique amp company. And I have the combos, the Fender, the Bogner Shiva. And Paul Reed Smith McCarty's. That's kind of what I've been leaning on live. And acoustic guitars, Gibson makes the best acoustic guitars. Back in the day, it was Taylor's, but I think Gibson's are a little bit more focused sound. Like each one has its own different, unique sound, which I really like, where all Taylor's really sound the same. Not that Taylor's not a great guitar. So that's, you know, I'm using a PRS McCarty with P90 pickups and a Bogner amp, and keep my effects pretty simple, because I think a good guitar and a good amp is your main focus. And then there's some, you can put some bells and whistles on, but we're a rock band, so not trying to get too processed here. I'll leave that to the keyboard player.
Yeah, that's the way I always felt, where you should be able to get what you need out of the guitar and amp.
That's what you're spending the big bucks on. You're going to put that all through a little like $300 pedal, and that's going to sound. This makes sense. But, you know, a little delays, a little chorus, a little wet is good, especially for live, because, you know, you don't want things too clean all the time live. Sometimes that gets a little abrasive.
Do you consider yourself a collector?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, I love my guitars. I've got more than, I'm grateful for each one I have, but I'm not. I like to get guitars I can play. And for the most part, that's what I have. A lot of Gibsons, a lot of Paul Reed Smiths. I've been lucky enough to be given and got my hands on a bunch of those. And then some old, you know, Strats and things like that that I've collected over the years that aren't like fancy, but, you know, they're cool sitting in my closet. They're not like 1969. Only tech bros and hedge fund managers can afford those these days.
Yeah, that's a shame, but that's the way that works now, huh? Do you use the same rig when you record?
When I record, no, because recording is a totally different thing. Usually I like a small, low wattage amp recording, so you can really crank it and break it up and get the mic can pick up some of that sound. Using my stage gear in a small studio space. And that's the same thing with Warhorse. I'm using a Magnatone 18-watt amp, which is fantastic for the little clubs that Warhorse plays. You know, the Shivas are 100 watt. My first gig with Warhorse, I used the Shiva on like two. So it was like this, I'm not really getting the most out of this amp. So I moved over to a Magnatone 18 watt, and it's fantastic for little clubs. You know, it breaks up at a low level. And I'm using a Gibson SG that just turned up in my closet one day, a gray one with mini humbucker pickups, which seems to be my kind of my local Southland, greater Los Angeles gig guitar. And with my Magnatone, you know, the pedal board's pretty similar, just a little dirt, little grunge, a morning glory pedal and a few effects, but nothing too over the top, and a wah-wah.
Okay, Chan, last question.
Yes, sir.
What's the best piece of advice that maybe somebody imparted to you or maybe something that you learned along the way?
Well, quite interestingly, and I guess it kind of came up in the discussion, I remember we had gotten signed to A&M, and we had our first album out, and we, you know, we weren't, it wasn't like climbing the charts or anything. And we were asking A&M for this, you know, asking them for a company for that. And then, and David Anderle, who at the time was head of A&R, which is artist relations for the company, a very famous guy in the business, David Anderle, he said to me, I remember after the show, he's like, you know what? It's like, it doesn't matter how much I like it or anyone in the company likes it. Until you guys make it happen for yourselves, no one's going to care. You've got to build your own momentum. And as soon as we smell money, we'll all jump on board. And that really is the case. No one's going to jump on board unless it looks like there's something in it for them. So any friends that are giving you some free time and help, thank them, because that's really, that's a special thing. People that are just doing it out of the goodness of their heart. No one in the business is, though. If they like you, it's because they smell money.
Yeah. Some things never change, huh?
No. But that's the way it is, you know. It forced us to stay after it, and the advice was good because it made us kind of create our own momentum and start instead of just whining to the record company to do this and that.
What did you do then? Did you tour more as a result?
We toured a lot. We came up with things like Horde. We put different packages together. Yeah, and we kept sending out our mailer and making sure to get, you know, to continue. We'd build all that up. We kind of really created our own little economy, and you know, slowly but surely the name got out there, the crowds got bigger. So I think by the time we got some songs on the radio 5 years later, things were ready to pop. And you know, the record company came along with us slowly but surely because it was slowly growing, you know, it was going in the right direction.
It doesn't seem like that would happen again today.
It's a totally different marketplace now. You know, you can get almost anything online. You just got to, but I do think making your own momentum, getting out and playing live, being creative in how you engage with your fans, even though it's a new marketplace, that's still the same thing we did back in the day. But you gotta feed the people good content. So nothing like a live show for that.
I think that's a good place to stop. Thanks so much for your time. It was great to meet you. I heard a lot about you from Paul. Obviously, he...
Oh, man. That's my homie.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.